From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Asia is on alert for Ebola outbreak. India and the United States express optimism about relationship after strategic dialogue. At Khmer Rouge Court, a long-awaited verdict approaches. These stories and more in this Friday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. The largest known outbreak of the lethal Ebola virus in West Africa is prompting authorities as far away as Asia to take preventative measures, although scientists say a global spread of the disease is not likely. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
At South Korea's Incheon International Airport, a major hub for air travel in Asia, quarantine inspections of arriving passengers are being enhanced. Authorities say all passengers are being recorded by an infrared camera to detect fevers. South Korea's foreign ministry spokesperson Han Hye-jin says this is being done because Ebola is becoming a big concern. She says the South Korean government, in association with health authorities, is paying attention and carefully determining if additional measures are needed. The country's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it established an Ebola task force in April and is prepared for possible infections in South Korea. It is also urging South Koreans not to visit the affected African countries. Australia is also cautioning against travel to Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Australia's chief medical officer, Chris Bagley, says the possibility of Ebola arriving there is very low. But all border protection agencies are on alert for possible symptoms in people arriving by air or sea. Dr. Nicholas Day, director of the Mahidol Oxford Tropical Medicine Research Unit in Bangkok, says these enhanced port screenings implemented in Asia during previous swine and bird flu scares are no panacea.
It hasn't really, to my knowledge, been conclusively proven that it's an effective public health measure. It makes people feel happier that something's being done. But remember that people with flu, for example, don't have to be symptomatic when they come through. If you're screening using an infrared camera for temperature detection, it doesn't necessarily pick up people who are infected. The same is true for Ebola.
The incubation period of the Ebola virus is between 2 and 21 days, during which time an infected person might not show any signs of infection. In Hong Kong, the Center for Health Protection says public hospitals will begin to report and test all those who developed fever who, within the past 21 days, traveled to the three affected African countries. Although there are no direct flights from West Africa to Hong Kong, the city's health minister, Dr. Ko Wing Man, expresses concern that infections could still enter the region via a plane flight. Hong Kong's health minister issued the warning following an emergency meeting held with specialists to discuss contingency plans should there be an outbreak there, some 13,000 kilometers from West Africa. Ko says suspected cases will be put into isolation as soon as they are identified. Suvarnabhumi, just outside Bangkok, is one of the world's busiest airports, with more than 30 million passengers passing through every year. Thai officials say only 30 to 50 persons per week are believed to come from the countries with the current Ebola outbreak. So far, no special screenings for Ebola among incoming passengers are being implemented, but all hospitals in Thailand are being ordered to monitor patients for any related symptoms, particularly those who have traveled to the outbreak area. Some airlines have suspended flights into the affected region, but health authorities say there is little risk of passengers contracting the virus on a flight from an infected person. Dr. Day, a tropical medicine researcher, explains Ebola is only spread through direct contact with blood, saliva, and other bodily fluids.
The reason why everyone's scared about this, and I think quite reasonably so, is that this is a particularly horrible disease. It's quite difficult to transmit unless you're in actual physical contact with a patient. So with standard public health and clinical isolation quarantine measures, it should be possible to contain any outbreak.
Since March, there have been more than 1,200 confirmed Ebola cases in West Africa. This is believed to be a new strain of the virus, and nearly 700 of those infected in this worst-known outbreak have died. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Rights groups are calling on China to release a prominent Uyghur academic who has been charged with splitting the state. Prosecutors Wednesday formally indicted Ilham Todi, a frequent critic of China's harsh treatment of minority Uyghurs. The 44-year-old Todi, who taught economics at Beijing's Central University for Nationalities, was arrested in January. Since his arrest, state media have implied Todi was the brains behind terrorist activity in the far west region of Xinjiang. But his commentaries and many interviews with foreign media do not suggest that he endorsed separatism. In a statement, Human Rights Watch says there is no publicly available evidence Todi incited violence or committed any other crime. The New York-based rights group says it is deeply disturbing Todi is being charged with separatism, which could result in a death penalty. The Chinese government has announced it has launched an antitrust investigation into Microsoft Corporation for what is called a lack of full disclosure about its Windows operating system and Office software. The announcement Tuesday follows a separate probe by the State Administration for Industry and Commerce into allegations Qualcomm, the world's largest mobile chip maker, is overcharging and abusing its market position. The U.S. firm could face a fine in excess of $1 billion. In a statement this week, Microsoft says it aims to build products that deliver the features, security, and reliability customers expect. And the statement said that they'll address any concerns the government may have. The state-run news agency Xinhua says nearly 100 SAIC inspectors visited Microsoft offices in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, and Chengdu Monday, taking internal documents and two computers. In May, central government offices were banned from using Microsoft's Windows 8 operating system on its computers. Xinhua said the country wants to avoid losing technical support for an operating system, as it did with Microsoft's Windows XP. Under China's 2008 anti-monopoly law, violators can be fined up to 10% of their previous year's sales revenues. Scott Harold is a RAND Corporation China analyst. He told VOA's Victor Beatty, Chinese leaders simply do not want strategic industry like information technology to be run or dominated by foreign companies.
Of course, part of China's strategy to accomplish its national development goals has for years been to try to copy or by any means possible procure, including by illegal means, procure the intellectual property of advanced corporations and incorporate those into Chinese products that can then displace those Western or foreign companies so that China does not have to rely on them. More recently, since especially the global financial crisis, we've seen China move towards a strategy of trying to pressure foreign companies that are operating inside China, and that's everything from Starbucks with investigations of how Starbucks is taking advantage of Chinese people by charging too much money for their product, to this latest instance of putting pressure on Microsoft. Microsoft's products, as you noted, are very widely available in China. In fact, at certain times, it's been alleged that almost every Chinese ministry uses an illegal copy of Microsoft's operating system. So it will be interesting to see what the impact of this is from a business perspective on Microsoft, but quite clearly, the pressure is on, and this is not just a case of Microsoft. This is a case of China essentially trying to pressure one after another large foreign companies and to try to either push them out of the China market or in favor of Chinese products, or to try to force them to give up some substantial penalty or some portion of their IP so as to support Chinese indigenous development goals.
What impact, if any, did the Edward Snowden revelations about spying on China have on these cases?
I'm not sure that I would draw a direct connection between any of the Snowden allegations, although, of course, China has long been jealous of and wary of foreign information service providers, whether those are software providers or even more so telecommunications providers. In fact, telecom was one of the areas that China refused to give anything on in the course of its WTO accession negotiation. But I think one of the things you could draw a more direct connection to is the Justice Department's decision to indict five serving PLA officers on claims that they are involved in nefarious activities to use cyber capabilities to hack U.S. firms to pilfer intellectual property. I believe that that's probably the more proximate major cause of this, if there is indeed a major cause. But as I said earlier, I think this is so much of a piece with China's larger approach to development. It's its leaders' fundamental belief that having products that are made by Chinese companies is better in some normative sense than having those products be made by foreign-branded companies, that even absent any Snowden revelations or Justice Department indictments, it would not at all have surprised me if this happened. And in fact, pressure on companies like Starbucks or Google, Yahoo, Twitter, any of the major companies, many of those happened before Snowden and will continue long after.
Harold says such actions could have a chilling effect on the ability of some firms to do business in China. He says at a time when the U.S.-China strategic partnership is under strain, the economic relationship has remained strong. Its actions against foreign firms could undermine that relationship. A Japanese legal panel has recommended indicting three former executives of the utility that runs the Fukushima nuclear power plant that was crippled by a tsunami in 2011. The independent 11-member panel ruled Thursday in favor of bringing charges against the former chairman and two ex-vice presidents of the Tokyo Electric Power Company. Prosecutors decided last year not to charge the TEPCO executives, saying the degree of devastation caused by the 9.0 magnitude earthquake and tsunami was unpredictable. A Thursday ruling means prosecutors will now have to reconsider that decision. If they still refuse to indict the TEPCO officials, the panel could force the case to go to court. At the conclusion of a strategic dialogue between India and the United States, both countries expressed optimism about improving their ties. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, where the talks were held.
After discussing issues ranging from trade and security to climate change, with his Indian counterpart, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that India and the U.S. can become indispensable partners in the 21st century.
The moment has never been more ripe to deliver on the incredible possibilities of the relationship between our nations.
The fifth round of the India-U.S. strategic dialogue on Thursday was the first high-level interaction between American officials and India's new government installed in May. The visit is seen as an effort to reverse a downward spiral in bilateral ties. With a range of differences on issues such as trade, tariffs and price controls, Kerry said that there is work to be done.
The words are easy. It's the actions we need to take that will really define the relationship in the days ahead. And I think it's safe to say that I said to the foreign minister that we all have a lot of homework to do.
Washington's chief concern remains barriers to trade by India. These barriers were a focus during Kerry's visit. His meetings with Indian officials took place as a deadline loomed over a global trade deal, which India has opposed unless its concerns are met on the right to buy grain from farmers at above market prices and stockpile it. Kerry urged India to join the agreement at the World Trade Organization. He said he understood India's concerns about providing food security to large number of poor people, but warned that it could stand to lose if the trade deal was scuttled. Despite the differences, both sides are keen to collaborate in a range of areas as India focuses on development goals and has indicated that it will undertake more economic reforms. The U.S. Secretary of State said there are dramatic opportunities in sectors such as high-end manufacturing, infrastructure, healthcare, and information technology, where American companies are world leaders and where India is seeking both investment and technology. Kerry will meet on Friday with Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is scheduled to visit Washington in September. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
With just 1 week before the final verdicts are delivered against former Khmer Rouge leaders, victims of Cambodia's bloody regime are hoping their turn for justice is finally at hand. From Phnom Penh, VOA's Kong Sothanarath wrote this report, narrated by Colin Lovett.
Chum May, an 82-year-old survivor of the Khmer Rouge, sits on a plastic chair outside his book kiosk in the courtyard of the former prison that once held him. He sells books about the Khmer Rouge and about himself in what is now called the Tuol Sleng Genocide Museum. He says he is now waiting to hear a verdict from the United Nations-backed Khmer Rouge Tribunal for two former leaders of the regime, Nguyen Che and Khieu Samphan. The court is expected to announce that verdict August 7th. He said he is happy to see there will be a verdict and that the entire world will be watching too. The first phase of the trial, which is coming to an end, focused on the forced exodus of Phnom Penh in 1975. John May says he will never forget the evacuation because he had to sleep amongst corpses with the smell of rotting bodies everywhere. The tribunal has sentenced just one Khmer Rouge defendant, Gangak U, better known as Duk, who received a life sentence for his role as supervisor of the Tuol Sleng Detention Center. Tuol Sleng survivor Bo Meng says anything less for Nguyen Che and Khieu Samphan will be too little. He says higher-level cadres ordered those below them, so if Duke was given a life sentence, the two senior leaders must get the same sentence. Nate Petra, Cambodian spokesman for the hybrid court, says he feels sure justice will be delivered. He says August 7th will be a historic date for Cambodians, with a verdict producing justice for both sides, the accused and the victims. But for Yuk Chung, the head of the Documentation Center of Cambodia, which conducts genocide research crucial to the trials, the completion of the trials should not overshadow a larger failure. He says as long as mankind fails to prevent more genocide from happening, victory cannot be declared. Nguyen Che and Khieu Samphan face charges for atrocity crimes, including genocide, in the second phase of their trial, which started Wednesday. As many as 2 million Cambodians died from starvation, overwork, and executions during the four-year rule of the Khmer Rouge, which attempted to create an agrarian communist utopia. For Kong Sosanarith in Phnom Penh, I'm Colin Lovett, VOA News.
It's Friday, a time when we like to take a look at the movies. It's not always to make history interesting, but a movie can, if it's done right. Daybreak Asia's Ray Kugel tells us about a documentary that proves it.
He was a great hero and a great criminal, all rolled up into one. He was a genius whose genius got completely out of control.
Sidney Rittenberg, known in China as Li Dunbai, is a man with a unique history. He is the only American to become a member of the Chinese Communist Party. Rittenberg was a prominent member of China's inner circle during the country's revolution.
I met Mao for the first time on the day I arrived in Yan'an. I walked in the door, and there he was. And I thought, it's like a picture right out of history.
And was a close friend of Chairman Mao Zedong. Rittenberg spent 35 years in China. In 1949, he was sentenced to 6 years of solitary confinement in Beijing Prison No. 2. On charges, he was part of an international spy ring.
Every day is miserable because you're alone, but you're not really alone, because every day you're sitting there with your own potential madness sitting across from you, watching you, and you know it's either you or him.
He was released in 1955 with an official apology. Rittenberg became a foreign expert at Radio Beijing to advise English radio broadcast issues, a job that provided him with privileged housing, entertainment, and a driver. He was jailed again in 1968 for 10 more years of solitary at the notorious Cheon Chung Prison because of his involvement in the Cultural Revolution. The feature-length documentary called The Revolutionary is a series of interviews with Rittenberg over a five-year period starting in 2005. It explains in riveting detail how Rittenberg achieved such prominence in China, the role he played in the party elite, initially as a translator, and how it all began for a man born in Charleston, South Carolina in 1921, who later became a student activist and union organizer in the American South. Through Rittenberg's words and vivid descriptions, there is an irony to his training as a linguist by the U.S. military that helped him fulfill his desires for social justice and support of China's communist revolution. He returned to the United States in 1980 with a wife and family, having survived major personal disruption. He'd able to go on as a valuable resource for U.S.-China dialogue and consultant on the global economy. Lucy Ostrander is producer of The Revolutionary. I spoke with her about Rittenberg's story and what made him so enamored with China in the first place.
I think he fell in love with the language because he fell in love with the people, and he believed in what the Chinese communists were embarking on. This is what he wanted to do. He was originally sent, when he was drafted to the U.S. Army, the Army sent him to their language school, which was at Stanford, and they originally wanted him to study Japanese. And he felt that if he was going to learn Japanese, he would end up in Japan during the occupation. He didn't want to do that. So he went to the Chinese professor and asked if he could study Chinese, and they let him. And after about a year, he was almost fluent and then was sent to China just as the war ended. He was soon completely fluent.
Rittenberg said that he loved to argue. Is that an overriding factor in his life, to be always so contrary?
Not the Sid I know. No, I don't know. He's got a great sense of humor, but he feels strongly in what he believes in. But I don't think he does it just to be contrary. I think he tries to stand up for what he believes in and educate people about what happened in China.
He was imprisoned twice for almost 16 years. Didn't his years in solitary confinement convince him that China is not the place for him? Or did he dislike the U.S. so much?
After the first year in prison, the Chinese were willing to let him go back. They realized they had made a mistake, and they offered to let him go back. But Sid didn't want to go back. He didn't realize it was going to take another 5 years for them to figure out his case. But he also didn't want to go back to the United States. He really believed in what the Chinese were doing. He wanted to stay there. And even after being in prison for 6 years, he wanted to stay on. And he wanted to continue to work with the party. I think he really loved doing that. He was in his element and rose up through the ranks and eventually became the head of the broadcast administration.
Now, Rittenberg said he never thought of giving up, yet he did say in the film he saw with his own eyes the tragic results of the social experiments, like the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, with untold millions of lives lost.
Yeah.
While he was there, what was he thinking?
I think he didn't really want to believe that. He was an idealist, and I think he didn't really believe what was happening until much later.
Does he have any regrets?
Yeah, I think he has some regrets. I think he feels he could have, you know, if he hadn't gotten involved with internal struggles within the party, he felt he could have done more.
Has the film played in China?
This would not be allowed to be shown in China. It was screened at the Foreign Correspondents Club in Beijing and Shanghai, but those were not considered public places.
What's been the audience reaction here in the United States to the film?
I think people either really love it or they hate it. Because the bulk of the film is an interview with Sid Rittenberg, who is an extraordinary raconteur. But we didn't use any archival footage. We used revolutionary Chinese posters as our visual motif and still photographs. And a lot of people, they want eye candy. They want more visual stimulation. And we felt that Rittenberg was such an incredible storyteller that we wanted to have him on as much as possible.
Rittenberg is a living part of history. And the revolutionary provides a first-hand view of one of the world's major geopolitical upheavals of the 20th century. The film is a memorable account of a man with a mission whose ideology may not be for everyone, but certainly one worth hearing and thinking about. This is a valuable primer on China's history, so important to understand now as the 21st century unfolds. I'm Ray Kugel.
This American who spoke fluent Chinese, who was from the generation of Yan'an, but unlike most of that generation, actively supported the Cultural Revolution. A revolution is not like inviting guests to dinner. It can't be that civilized, that courteous, that gracious, that gentle.
For more information, you can go to their website, revolutionarymovie.com. We're happy that you're listening to us on voanews.com. The latest world news is coming your way next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for stopping by Daybreak Asia.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how.